This is the homily for the Baptism of the Lord and the Solemn Profession of Brother Cyprian Morales, 2026 at St. Anselm's Abbey. The readings for the day's Mass were the Book of the Prophet Isaiah, chapter 42, verses 1-4 and 6-7, the Acts of the Apostles, chapter 10, verses 34-38, and the Gospel of Matthew, chapter 3, verses 13-17. The homilist was Abbot James Wiseman.
Now, when I look back on the day of my own final or solemn profession many years ago, what I know for certain is that Abbot Alban Boltwood presided and preached. His homilies were always well thought out, but like most of the homilies that any of us have ever heard, I've long since forgotten the details of what he said. And that will surely be the case with anything I say on this Sunday. It would be normal, I suppose, at a profession mass to talk about stability or obedience or the whole tradition of monastic life, which we usually refer to by the Latin term conversatio morum. But instead, I'm going to focus on what I consider really even more basic than any of those particular parts of the overall profession. That will be based in part, at least, on some of the things I've been reading recently or even been asked to read. And even though you'll probably long forget what I said in any detail, I'll at least refer to an image that you might keep with you. It's an architectural image, and it does tell us something important about Benedictine life. Those of you who sometimes attend our evening vespers here at the monastery know that the sheets that separate one day from the other in that three-ring Vespers binder always have an image on it. And one of these, and it actually happened to come up just a couple days ago on Friday of what we call week two, it's really nothing more than an aerial view drawing of what an early medieval monastery looked like. It shows a church, along with a quadrangle around one side of the church, with windows here and there, and not much else. It's really pretty simple. And even that stone structure that we see in that drawing in our Vespers binder, that same structure was almost certainly somewhat more advanced from any of the monasteries that St. Benedict once started, either at Subiaco or somewhat later at Monte Cassino. What characterized a monastery in that early medieval period did, however, make visible something that's quite clear from the wording of St. Benedict's rule, namely that the monks were usually right there in the cloister or in the church. Now, St. Benedict does for certain mention the possibility or even the likelihood that sometimes the monks would be needed to work outside the cloister in the adjacent fields to help harvest the crops that were growing there and providing most of the food for the monastic community. And Benedict also writes that at times some of the monks would have to travel away from the monastery on one or another kind of business, but understood this as somewhat exceptional. And he expresses his concern for those who have been away on such travel. He writes in chapter 67 of the rule, "Brothers sent on a journey will ask the abbot and the entire community to pray for them, in case they may have been caught off guard on the way by seeing some evil thing or hearing some idle talk." Now, I think to most of us that probably sounds excessively apprehensive, but it was surely supported by the experience of St. Benedict and by other monastic legislators. They expected monks normally to be right at the monastery. Now, let me jump a few centuries ahead. I'll refer to another drawing, but this time a much more famous one. This was the plan of St. Gall. It's the only surviving major architectural drawing from roughly that 700-year period from the end of the Western Roman Empire until the 13th century. Now, in fact, that plan of St. Gall, that architectural drawing, was never put into effect as such. But it nevertheless tells us something significant about the way monasticism evolved from the time of St. Benedict back in the 6th century. This plan of St. Gall not only depicts a section for the novitiate, where young monks would be trained to the ways of monastic life, but that drawing also has what is usually called an outer school, located not within the monastic enclosure, but built right up against one of the exterior walls of the monastery. And there, the children of the neighborhood would receive their education. Now, that this practice has caught on to such an extent that many, and perhaps even most monasteries today, continue that kind of work, whether it be in an elementary school, a grammar school, middle school, a high school, four-year college, university offering graduate degrees, or perhaps sometimes a seminary where men are trained for the diocesan priesthood. Now, I'm not criticizing that development. I myself would not have applied to this particular monastery apart from the educational work that's always been part of the life here. I would not have felt at home in a monastery where the work was largely pastoral or agricultural. My main point is that this does represent a development from what St. Benedict understood monastic life to be. For most monks today, the motto, pray and work, ora et labora, means that, in fact, our work will be quite different from that's found in a 6th century monastery, where it was done either by craftsmen monks who worked right there in the monastery itself and perhaps made things that could be sold at their gift shop, or perhaps work outside in the adjacent fields. But work of any sort, whether it be back in the 6th century or today, work of any sort can take on a life of its own and to overrule what has been traditionally called the contemplative side of our life. And it's that side of our life that I'd like to focus on a bit this morning. Fred brings up the question, just what is meant by that adjective contemplative or by the corresponding noun contemplation. The monk who was surely the most prolific and widely read monk of the last century or so, and perhaps of all time, was Thomas Merton. And you probably know that of his many books, a lot of them contain in the very title either the adjective contemplative or the noun contemplation. He wrote books, for example, with titles such as Seeds of Contemplation, New Seeds of Contemplation, Contemplation in a World of Action, and another book called Contemplative Prayer. Well, as many articles that he wrote, they often had such terminology in the title of those articles. And he even would deal with that subject, even if the topic was not mentioned in the title of that particular book or article that he wrote. Not surprisingly, his own understanding of contemplation evolved over the years, but he rightly understood that in one sense or another, contemplation does have a central place, not just in the life of a monk, but in the life of any Christian. I would even go as far as to say in the life of any human being. And yet, what does that terminology mean? Well, there's something truly basic in a small book that I was just asked to write a book review for a Benedictine journal. The author was a man named Jacob Rieff. He's a Benedictine oblate, spent many years at the monastic foundation in Oklahoma that had been founded by Sister Pascaline Koff, I think around 1980, and she was the foundress and superior there until poor health required her return to her home monastery in Clyde, Missouri. Now, this is not at all the time to try to summarize Rieff's book, even though it's really not very long. But I want to note that he rightly insists on two things, and I think these are things worth remembering. First of all, contemplation is not simply something that monks do. And secondly, contemplation in itself is distinct from what we usually call contemplative prayer. So in itself, contemplation really is a common experience. That's something that we perhaps seldom think about. It's not the so-called discursive, that is the step-by-step thinking that our reasoning power often is occupied about. That power settles down in contemplation and we simply behold what is present to us. We simply behold what is real. You might want to use a capital letter R for that word. You simply become aware of what's real. Jacob Riff writes that this might occur simply when we're sipping a cup of coffee in the morning, looking out the window, or when we hear bird songs splashing all over the yard of our house or of our monastery, or when we simply peer into the dark as we lie in bed waiting to go to sleep at night. Or again, this might be when we hear a particularly moving song, or when we're stopped in our tracks by a wonderful painting in a museum. All of that really is contemplation. And we all do it. We all do it, certainly at times. And yet, as I pointed out, the second point that Ref makes, that in itself is not yet contemplative prayer. That comes about only when we simultaneously come aware of our relationship with God, when we direct that contemplative rest and beholding, we direct that towards our Creator, whatever the particular moment presents to us. Now, I'm not going to go on at great length about this, but it does point out the possibility or even the probability of our contemplative moments becoming prayer. And yet, note, this does require some degree of mortification. That's a word that often has bad press among spiritual writers, but there's a point to it. In Riff's opinion, this mortification today may mostly mean resisting the temptation of what he calls the always-on way of life. Always-on in the sense of constantly checking one's smartphone, whether you're waiting in a line or walking down a corridor or having a meal or in general, just trying to keep up with what's going on in our extraordinarily fast-paced world, far more fast-paced than it was in the time of Benedict. And the problem is that this always-on attitude prevents us from having that simple contemplative awareness of life that's actually going on around us all the time, but we're often oblivious to it. All of us, I think, face the danger of giving in to what Rieff rightly calls the digital domain, a digital domain where we almost are at least almost constantly online in one way or another. He suggests that one way to resist falling prey to that domain is to do what St. Basil the Great urged centuries ago in one of his great works. Basil wrote, "We ought let the created world around us so penetrate our awareness or consciousness that even the smallest plant, the smallest thing growing, might bring us to some remembrance of our Creator." Riff names various kinds of small flowers that could elicit such remembrance. Perhaps it be a blossom growing in an oak savanna, or a crusty stalk of lichen growing on a branch that we just pass by as we're walking along on the sidewalk. He speaks mostly of plants serving that role. Others have found the same possibility of contemplation in small animals. I was recently reading a book that just came out a short time ago, beautiful book, by an English woman named Chloe Dalton, and it's titled Raising Hare, H-A-R-E. And she writes about raising a tiny newborn hare that she happened to see in her garden, something that led her to decide to take time off work, commuting from her rural home to London, often traveling worldwide as a member of the British Foreign Office to study and write about all sorts of political issues. Chloe writes of learning so much from that little female animal as it grew, saying of the hare, and I quote from the book here, "She," that is the hare, "she has taught me patience. And as someone who's made a living through words, she made me consider the dignity and persuasiveness of silence," which is something you'd expect to find normally to some considerable degree in a monastery. She goes on, the little hair made me reevaluate my life. I've learned to savor beautiful experiences while they last, however small and domestic they may be. The sensation of wonder that she excited in me continues to burn, showing me aspects of my life that I thought were set in stone, but in fact are as malleable as wax and may be shaped and reshaped. And what Chloe Dalton describes there is what could, in any of us, could become contemplative prayer if we direct that kind of experience to the Lord who made us and who made the world around us. The entire Benedictine way, whether it's lived by monks or by nuns or sisters or oblates, is rooted in precisely this kind of awareness. There are many things that we're not called to do and ought not even try to do, but the kind of calling to which Brother Cyprian is going to now make profession is a wonderful way to cultivate that kind of contemplation in daily living, and ideally allowing it to become genuine prayer. As Jacob Riff writes at the very end of his short book, this kind of life resists the treatment of the world and ourselves as consumers or as producers or as commodities. It expands the heart to see the wondrous excess of the Creator's world, to give thanks for it, to revel in it, to see that in such gratitude and reveling, there's the calling to share this great vision with all of our brothers and sisters. It's a calling that goes all the way down. I think in one way or another, this is a vision that any of us can receive and share. One of the perks of monastic life, if I may so speak of it, one of the perks is that Saint Benedict really does keep things rather simple. His rule, as I think you know, is only 73 short chapters long. In some edition, that doesn't even quite cover 100 pages of print. Even our congregational constitutions are not very long. Like any calling in life, Benedictine monasticism does have its challenges. But the bare-bones structure is really quite simple and straightforward, just as is the gospel itself. It's to this way of life that Brother Cyprian will now be making a solemn profession. And if in following St. Benedict's rule, we do what our holy patron asks in his 72nd chapter that he titles Good Zeal, and that really talks about some of the ways in which we can lovingly put the needs of others before our own, if we do that, we may be confident that in living this way, and in his words, preferring nothing whatever to Christ, then Christ Jesus in turn will bring us all together to eternal life.